Good evening.
Good evening.
You hear okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, Zen practice has not been in the West, the Western world, for not for a long time. Zen came to the West, to United States and to England and to Europe, Latin America, just as recently as the 1960s, and that's not very long ago. And in those very early days, the 60s, we didn't know, we didn't understand the practice, we didn't know what it was. It's looked attractive, looked exciting, looked significant, but we really didn't understand it naturally. So, but we admired it. We admired the idea of Zen practice and what it stood for, and we studied it, studied the books and studied lectures, and we kind of added it to our collection, like Americans do, like Westerners do. Zen, I put it in my collection. It was kind of seen in that way. It was understood, we tried to understand it intellectually. We hoped that by doing that we would gain some knowledge. There was a lot of promise and we were very excited about it. What we didn't understand at that time, or the way we understood it, in the limited way that we understood it, it was really impersonal and external to ourselves. Not a commodity, something to talk about. You go to a party and you talk about the book you read and that meditation retreat that you sat in, something to talk about. And in those early days, very, very few people in this country and in the Western world had any experience with Zen. And today, there are many Zen students. All over the world, there are many Zen students. And today, I believe we have a deeper understanding of what this practice is. A bit of a deeper understanding. We now know that this practice is quite personal. We are not separated from it. We are involved. We have to be involved in it. And we know now that this practice is about living our lives according to what I will call the three characteristics of Zen. Tonight I would like to talk about what I feel are three characteristics of Zen practice. Those are wisdom and compassion and character. So the first one is wisdom. And wisdom is, you know, not limited to knowledge, facts, or information. Wisdom is not information about life. Knowledge and you can come in. You know, knowledge and information. We can put them on a piece of paper or on a computer. And we can put information and knowledge into our memory. Carry it here. And we can talk about it. And of course, it's knowledge and information are necessary for our everyday life. But as we understand, and as our practice emphasizes, knowledge and information will change tomorrow. Not only will it change, but it'll grow. The information, that we have about our world and the knowledge we have about our world has become larger. So it's constantly changing. But even though they are changing, knowledge, information, even though they are changing, they are static. They're static things. Because they have boundaries and they have limits. Information and knowledge, wherever we store it. Piece of paper, you know, on your laptop or, you know, here. They are restricted to mental activity, intellectual activity, knowledge, information. So they have boundaries. They are restricted in that way. They can only go so far. But wisdom, on the other hand, is not about storing information and recalling it when it's we need it or when it's convenient. Wisdom is much more dynamic than that. Wisdom is about being alive. And seeing life completely without limits. And wisdom is not something you store on a PC. And this, wisdom is about seeing life completely, and the word seeing, to see it, that's not exactly the best word to describe it, but it's close enough. Seeing is not the best way to describe what happens when wisdom arrives, because the seeing that comes from wisdom is without limits. And it is how we appreciate our life, wisdom. We appreciate our life because it has no limits. Wisdom has no limits. Fundamentally, wisdom is really about how all the elements of the world relate to each other and how they interact and how they coalesce and how they support each other. And this relationship that all elements have, this relationship is constantly changing and constantly moving. So there are no boundaries. There are no boundaries between elements, which means there are no elements. You can't define an element of your life because it is constantly shifting and moving and changing. If you try to describe it or measure it by reaching for its boundaries, you cannot. The only way you can understand it is by your wisdom. So wisdom, you know, the first quality of, first characteristic of Zen practice, wisdom, we can't talk about it with each other in everyday terms. It's beyond that. So in the Zen literature, the teachers use poetry and gestures and their activity to demonstrate understanding, to express their wisdom and their understanding. They don't engage in words, they in fact discourage it. So after wisdom, the next characteristic of Zen practice, I believe, is compassion. And it relates to wisdom. It's related to wisdom. Compassion means, and wisdom shows us, that there is no separation between ourself and other beings, human beings and other beings. No separation. And that takes place, that recognition of no separation takes place when we are selfless. And we see that the relationship that we have with each other has no boundaries. There is a feeling of oneness, and continuity, continual connection. There's an unbroken connection. This is wisdom, and it's also the basis for compassion. It's the unbroken connection between ourselves and everything else. I was given an example of this the other day when someone said to me, I went for a hike and a tree spoke to me. That's all. That's the sense of an unbroken connection. So, compassion exists before there is mental activity. Compassion, of course, doesn't start with thinking about being compassionate. Compassion starts with a feeling. We see a situation or see someone and we want to reach out. It starts with a feeling, and that's why we say compassion comes from the heart. You know, not from the mind, it comes from the heart. And compassion is not static, always engaged, always engaged. The third characteristic of Zen practice is character. You know, we didn't know that back in the 1960s. But we know it today. Zen is about character, which in turn is the source of wisdom and compassion, our character. And the character that we encourage in ourselves is inspired by our feeling to live our life authentically. It's like we are telling ourselves constantly, I'm not going to compromise with living according to the truth. And if we are to have such determination, we need a character to follow through. So we say that to have a strong sense of character means to have a quiet and firm sense of right and wrong. A sense of right and wrong. Without having to look up anything. Is that right or wrong? Look it up. We don't. Character tells us what it is. And character, much like compassion, is about sacrificing one's own self-interest in the service of others. Which really means to live in accordance with a larger truth. And to honor our own worthiness. This is character. In other words, character means to be real. You know the poet Mary Oliver? You know Mary Oliver? Brilliant, I think. Something she said, I think, describes what we're talking about. She said, I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So this is the basis of it. This is the basis of character. I don't want to be just a visitor. So if we are to practice, when we practice according to these three characteristics, it means to transmit the Buddha's mind, to express and bring into being Buddha's mind, which means there is no such thing as a small self or a small mind. When we practice according to these characteristics, our small mind, our everyday limited mind, finds its place in the big mind. And then we have peace. So if we try to run this world, this divisive world that we live in, if we try to run it with ideas about what is good and what is bad and what we believe, those ideas of good and bad will not help us or help others. Before we have ideas of good and bad, we must find our place in the world. We must know where we stand and how we stand. And that requires living life and having experiences. Big experiences. Unlimited experiences, more than just egotistic experiences or very narrow experiences. But big experience that bring wisdom. There's a old ancient Zen saying from somewhere in China. I don't remember where I read it, but it stayed here like information. The saying said, people who are very good often are not good. I puzzled about that for a time. I realized that what that poet was trying to say was that sometimes people who are very, very competent are also very egotistic. And this happens when we emphasize seeking something that we think is very good. We're seeking something that we feel has great value. If we constantly have our vision on that something, seeking that something, we will be distracted. We will constantly be distracted from what's going on around us. And that doesn't help our wisdom, to be constantly focused on achieving something very good, even though the something may be of great value to people, a great medical breakthrough or something. Problem is if it's not balanced, if that seeking for some great value is not balanced, we will be distracted, and then there's the risk of making a mistake because we don't see things with wisdom. But with our practice, we become willing to accept things and people who are very ordinary, very down to earth, not assigned a great value. We're willing to accept something ordinary or even not so good. When our mind is open or accepting to something that people usually term bad and that most people would like to avoid, that's the mind that's really open. You know, there's famous story about Suzuki Roshi that's in the book Crooked Cucumber. It's the kind of a legend about him. He would, when he would go shopping for fruits and vegetables, He didn't look for the most beautiful apple, you know. He looked for one that maybe was a little bit damaged. Not the freshest.
When he could have had a fresh one.
He looked for one that wasn't highest quality. Because his mind was really open. He didn't judge. He said, this is good. This is okay. It was an expression of his open mind. Of a mind that didn't say, I want just what's in this limits. I don't want that. He said, he thought and he felt everything is good. And when we see the truth, the value, the inherent value in all things and in all people, it's hard not to be Buddha. So when our life is guided by this practice, we can never be lost. So many people feel lost these days and have been for several generations, I'm afraid. But when our life is guided by this practice, we cannot be lost. We always know where we are and we always know who we are. So when we keep a mind of practice, we will always appreciate our life and we will always enjoy our life even when we experience difficulties and suffering. But when we have no idea of practice, we lose ourselves. And we lose the meaning of our life. And we don't understand the purpose of our life. In the modern world, there's a lot of emphasis on excitement and enjoyment. And if we believe or feel that the purpose of our life is to emphasize enjoyment, we can't enjoy our life. This is the paradox. This strive to enjoy our life at all costs means we're not enjoying our life. Because something is missing. So the purpose of our life has nothing to do with obtaining something in the future. The purpose of our life is not tied up with some goal down the road. The purpose of our life is not a thing to be achieved. It's okay to have those goals and have a purpose like that. We can create many useful things that way. But that's not the main event. That should not be the underlying foundation of our life. You know, if we feel that the purpose of our life is to enjoy ourselves, and we feel we're not enjoying ourselves, we don't feel so good. I'm working really hard to enjoy myself, and I'm not. We don't feel so good. We feel angry. We feel sick. Feel unwell. Why aren't I enjoying myself? I'm working so hard for it. So, the pursuit of enjoyment is an illness. And Dogen expressed it this way: sickness does not destroy people. No practice destroys people. So, I think most of you, if not all of you, have a very busy life these days here. And when you do have a very busy life and have many things you have to take care of and you have many responsibilities, you may worry, can I do it? How am I going to handle all this? How can I take care of all these things? I'm overwhelmed. But when your life is based on practice, your busyness will not destroy you. You will feel confidence while taking care of all these things. But without practice, you become ill and you feel crazy with all these responsibilities. So, I think that most people who come to Zen practice, you know, the first time, they're looking to obtain something, achieve something, peace of mind or no stress or something. And that's normal and that's natural and that's okay when we first come to the practice. It's quite normal. But if that desire to achieve something continues, then we will be overwhelmed by our busy life. But if with continued practice, the mind shifts, the mind turns away from a future achievement to the experience of composure in Zazen, and we understand the importance of starting our activity from a substantial place, then the practice is becoming grounded. But the mind has to shift, turn away from achievement to the feeling we have when we sit quietly and our mind is taking a rest. With that experience of composure in Zazen, we come to recognize that the activity of our life has to start from a place of no activity. When we practice here and we come early in the morning, before the first cup of coffee and before breakfast and before all those things, before turning on the radio or looking at our email, if we begin with this quiet practice and then step off into our activity, we've started our day from a place of no activity. Clean. No limits. So Zazen is our starting point. In Zazen, we are not creating, we are not trying to create some activity. We're just sitting quietly, being aware, and letting the sound of the bird appear. Does anyone have a question? Dave.
Last one, you spoke of wisdom. I couldn't help thinking of one of my favorite lines of poetry. In the Four Quartets, T.S. Eliot says, "The only wisdom we can hope to attain is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless." And at first I was puzzled because it seemed to me that that was a very pessimistic view of wisdom that was much more limited than what you were talking about. But then it seemed to me that coming from a Western literary tradition, he's really talking about wisdom in the intellectual sense of what you were saying about knowledge and information. And that actually what he's getting at is very much consistent with what you were saying, that if we see wisdom as something to attain, the only way out of that trap is to realize the limitations, to have some humility about that form of wisdom, about knowledge and information. And if humility is endless, then the wisdom of humility is endless and unbounded. It's a different notion of wisdom, I think, very much in line with what you were saying. I guess Eliot is supposed to be the great Catholic poet, but he always sounds kind of like a Buddhist to me.
Yes, very, very wise. Thank you. Yes, Dick.
It sounds to me like the wisdom and compassion character that would accrue from Zen practice is not that accessible to young people, because it seems like it's a mature practice. It requires time. You can't immediately become acquire these, if it's probably not the right word, but acquire those three characteristics without practice. So young people have not had the time to sit and practice Zen and do Zazen. So it seems like that whole younger group is not going to be capable of reaching, again, not a very good term attached to it, but reaching some sort of a level of wisdom and compassion and character. I mean, they can start. It's a start. They have to start somewhere, but eventually it seems like time has to pass and practice has to deepen before that.
But I think it starts to occur at an early age. We've all seen examples of young children helping somebody when there's danger. And making good decisions at a very early age. So I think it can happen pretty young. But of course, it can happen pretty young when experiences are beginning to accumulate. Before we have experiences, it's pretty impossible to have wisdom. But as experiences accumulate, we can develop wisdom and compassion. Thank you. Yes, Andy.
What Dave said resonated with me. So we use the same words, wisdom, compassion, and character in everyday life, but it comes across differently. Could you contrast the two other words, compassion and character, contrast them in the context of what you said versus how we think about it in an everyday external scenario?
So your question is, how do we see compassion in everyday terms, rather than Buddhist terms, or what?
Could you contrast that? Because when you use the same words, when you use the words compassion, character, and wisdom, it means different from how we use it in an everyday world. Wisdom is thought of as intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion is thought of as maybe give $10. Could you contrast that?
Yes. In our everyday world, we do things according to convenience and expediency and opportunity. And so, at one moment, we may see somebody in trouble and compassion arises. But in the Buddhist sense, compassion and character and wisdom are not expedient things, or they don't arise according to the moment. They are always present. Always present. And we simply manifest them at the right time, and the time is right. It would be like, that's a good, oh, you know, there's a story associated with being a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout. You know, help somebody cross the street today. And the little girl, the little boy comes home, hi Mom, I helped a lady cross the street. See, I was helpful, I was compassionate, and that was my duty for the day. I had one minute of compassion. See, I did my duty. But in our practice, it's not about a once a day thing. It's always ready to help, and we don't have to tell anybody we did it. So it's connected and continuous, and always flowing and unfolding, not static. Yeah. Compassion and character are not one-time events. Thank you. Yes, please.
You spoke about practice, and I think I have more clarification question. When you spoke about practice, you spoke about stillness and not activity. Although I wonder whether practice also can involve activities such as yoga, or walking, or practicing while cooking, practicing while doing something in some activity, but still being able to kind of calm the mind and be still. Would that count as a practice?
If we want to have a mind of stillness in all those activities, we have to start from a place of no activity. We have to start there. We have to return to our root. So we won't know about stillness when we are cooking if we haven't experienced stillness when there's no activity. But if we practice, if we start our activity from no activity, then everything we do is just like you say, expresses practice. But we have to start from that place. It's a good question. Thank you. Is Bonnie?
I've been thinking about your question and about what came to mind for me. My sister wrote me a birthday card, and she, apologized to me. She said, you know, when we were younger, I never realized how many problems you had. I never was able to help very much. You wouldn't tell me about your problems, and, you know, I wish I'd been able to support you more. And my sister's much younger than me, 10 years. So when I was a teenager, she was 5 years old, 6 years old. And I thought about those times and how sometimes in my family there'd be fights about money and arguments and stress. And my sister was born like perfect. I remember the day she was born and seeing her in the hospital and her little eyes and like sleeping peacefully. And she was just in heaven, you know? And so we'd have all these problems at home or whatever, and then she would just come and be like, Bonnie, watch Winnie the Pooh with me, let's do this. And I was remembering that, and I said to her, you have no idea how much you helped me just by being yourself and being joyful. You know, so then I was thinking, babies and children have a certain kind of wisdom that it's almost like we all have it and then we start to forget. And it's more about remembering wisdom than it is about discovering or learning for me. So I just thought of that, you know, like, it's how, like, the question is, how do we return to that state of bliss and happiness and just being together and sharing openly and hugging and as life starts to accumulate on us through our teen years, and then there's school and then there's work and all the stress, but how do we remember what it's like to just be free like that? So that's what I thought of.
Yes, please.
I was just thinking about his question about in real life, wisdom, character, and all these words. Really, for me, it is like somebody you might think is really wise, and wonderful character, very helpful and everything. But it is now practically, it is very circumstantial. You know, as long as everything is fine, and this person is helping, being kind and everything. But for example, if the circumstances change, the person changes. Simple thing, very nice, very soft-spoken, very wise person, goes in a traffic, something goes wrong, that's it. You know, the whole thing has gone out of the door. You can see that. It is very hard to see anybody who is really, really wise, you know, and can maintain it in all circumstances. I think from what I'm hearing from your talk is the practice we do here helps to maintain our calm and that character we're talking about in all circumstances and not lose it, you know, when the scene changes. So, for example, it's very easy to help anybody with a $10 or $20, you know, when you are having everything. But when you lose everything or when you feel that you've been cheated yourself, it changes. You may not do it. So how do you tie the wisdom, character, and everything in all circumstances? Where do you find such a person?
Where do you find such a person? Here. There. You be that person. Thank you. Yes, Anna.
To try to have good character, but is character something that we should be putting effort into, or is it like if you think you're being selfless, you're probably being selfish? If you think I'm going to have good character, that might be your ego talking, so you should just trust the practice to bring it to you.
Mm-hmm.
it starts with a promise we make to ourselves, like a vow, which is something like, I will not be overwhelmed by anything that happens. I will stay with what I feel to be the truth. I will not stray. A promise we make. I think that's the basis of character. A promise we make to ourselves to live life according to the truth of it as we see it. Thank you. Yes, Jaya.
Thank you for really a great talk. So, would it be fair to say then that in Zen practice, we believe that these three characteristics are inherent in every person, and that, because we don't see it in every person, but they're there, but perhaps because of their experiences as children, you know, as they're growing, or for whatever reason, or choices they've made, or because they don't practice, that we don't see that in everyone. Would that be a fair statement? And would that be correct to say that?
Yes, that would be fair. We know that there are things that happen to us in life, and there are conditions that we are born into and that we are surrounded by that influence us and shape us, that can create misunderstanding. So it's fair to say that. I think that's real, very realistic. And I also feel it's a kind of expression of compassion to admit that and not just simply criticize somebody or dismiss somebody when they behave in a harmful way, to say that the person is inherently evil. We say, their wisdom has not unfolded yet. That's the nature of our practice. So we try to express these qualities and put them into the world. So it's compassionate to see people that way. Thank you. Yes, please. Oh, okay.
To your question, you just said a thought. My neighborhood, Palo Alto, have a lot of really successful neighbors. And a lot of them don't fit the mold that you would think a very successful person should come from. A lot of them have made huge mistakes in their life. And from that, they have greater clarity in their life later on. So I think it's kind of if I'm understanding the question right, I think it's a mistake to look at someone and say that, you know, you're going off the path or what you're doing is going to hinder you in some way. Because I think a lot of times when you make big mistakes in life, like Dogen said, his whole life is a mistake. Sometimes when you make big mistakes in life early on, you get so much more clarity later in life, and it leads to tremendous understanding.
Thank you. That's a very good point. Of course. Yes. Yes, please.
Well, it seems to be part of our nature, the kind of our connection to this wisdom, compassion, and even character is kind of variable. Sometimes we're closer to it, and other times not. I often feel that I've done something that's not particularly wise or not particularly compassionate, but often I have no idea how to be better. And so sometimes it feels that kind of aiming to be this compassionate and wise and characterful person is not somehow enough. So how does one deal with that? It's just a kind of, if the only answer is, well, aim to be this person, sometimes it kind of doesn't feel like enough of an answer. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Well, it's true what you say. It's not necessary to try to achieve those qualities. It's probably a mistake. So we don't try to achieve wisdom or try to achieve character. We just sit. We just sit quietly and let our mind be quiet. And let those qualities arise. And and we watch ourselves. And we see those parts of ourself that we would like to improve. We see parts of ourselves that sometimes get in the way. And so we work on them, and maybe we're successful at changing them, maybe not. But while we're working on them, our character is being built up. Without saying, I'm going to work on my character today. we come to the practice and just sit. So you're right. We don't have to worry about achieving those three qualities. Just return to our sitting and let them appear. Thank you. Yes, please. Can we wait a second? Why don't you wait a second? We'll give you the microphone. That'd be better.
So how can
Bonnie, did you hear enough so that you could?
Yeah, I can recap. She basically is saying that in her own life, sometimes people that she's been close to have had very good intentions or say that they're trying to help, but it's actually causing harm. And so, given that you have good intentions, how can you know that it's actually going to have a good result? Was there anything else?
Yeah, that the good compassion and good intention and good character and whatever you think it's going to do good, it obviously coming out of good character, good place, turns out to be destructive to someone that you love even. That will happen sometimes. And quite often we can't prevent it, because the person with good intention to be very helpful may do something but didn't understand that there was something else happening here that would get in the way. They just didn't know. So sometimes that happens. So what we're always trying to do is to see as much as we can and not be surprised by something that we hadn't paid attention to. And of course that's where this practice comes in. It helps our mind see in a larger way. But what you describe will happen. People with good intentions and doing the right thing may miss something, and the result doesn't turn out so good. So knowing that, when we know that can happen, we just simply try to do our best to see everything before we take some action. It's a complex question. Very complex. Thank you.